Late night monitors. Steady floor. Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So imagine you have this incredibly tough industrial cleaning job.
Right, like something really stubborn.
Exactly. And you have two incredibly powerful chemical solvents.
Okay.
Now, individually, they do an okay job on the grime. But you realize that if you mix them together, their combined reaction destroys the grime flawlessly.
I feel like there's a catch here.
There's a massive catch. There is one big problem. The moment you mix them, the chemical reaction is so violently intense that it completely melts the bucket you are using.
Yeah, that would be an issue.
Right. So if you're listening to this, you can probably guess that in the world of oncology, the grime is an advanced solid tumor. The chemicals are two very specific cancer drugs. And the bucket, the thing that basically keeps melting, is the patient's entire bone marrow system.
Yeah, that is a fantastic analogy. And, you know, today we celebrate the work of the oncology researchers behind a remarkable 2025 paper in Nature Communications, who have advanced our understanding of the DNA damage response.
Because it's a huge step forward, right?
Right.
Our mission for this deep dive is to explore how these researchers essentially, well, hacked the timing and delivery of existing cancer drugs.
Yeah, to unlock a combination therapy that was historically considered way, way too toxic for human use. What's fascinating here is that their work is this brilliant pivot from what chemicals we use to how and when we deploy them inside the human body.
Because finding that balance between aggressively killing a tumor and actually sparing the patient's healthy tissue is, it's basically the ultimate puzzle in cancer research.
It really is, it's the whole game.
Okay, let's unpack this. If the bucket melts the moment these drugs meet in the bloodstream, what is the actual biological explosion happening at the cellular level? I mean, why did doctors even want to combine these two specific drugs in the first place?
Right. So to understand the combination, we have to look at the cellular machinery that keeps us alive, specifically the DNA damage response, or DDR.
The DDR.
Yeah. Every time a single cell divides, it has to unzip and copy its entire DNA sequence. It's this highly complex physical process, and, you know, naturally mechanical mistakes happen.
Like typos in a document.
Exactly. The DDR is the cell's built-in repair crew that detects and fixes those typos. Now, cancer cells are notoriously unstable. They are dividing chaotically and constantly.
Meaning they're making a massive amount of copying errors.
Huge amounts. Because of that, they rely heavily on this DDR machinery just to survive their own reckless growth.
Right. If you are dividing that fast, your spell checker has to be working overtime.
That is the perfect way to look at it. And that brings us to the two drugs. So the first is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, or a TOP1 inhibitor. Topoisomerase 1 is an enzyme that acts like a molecular swivel. When DNA unzips to be copied, it gets tangled and twisted. So this enzyme temporarily snips one strand of the DNA to relieve the tension, lets it untwist, and then reseals it.
It's like untangling a phone cord.
Yes. But the inhibitor drug-like camptothecin sabotages this process. It lets the enzyme make the snip, but prevents it from resealing the cut. It intentionally leaves a single strand break in the DNA.
Okay, so drug number one goes in and deliberately leaves the tumor cell's DNA physically snapped open during replication.
Right.
But a single strand break isn't always fatal to a cell, right? I mean, wouldn't the cell's spell checker just call in the repair crew to fix the snip?
It would, which is exactly where drug number two enters the picture. A PRP inhibitor, like olaparib.
Ah, okay.
PROP is a protein that acts as the cell's first responder to single strand DNA breaks. Now, originally, scientists thought PRP inhibitors just blocked this protein from doing its repair job.
The stop sign.
Right, but they actually do something far more devious. They physically trap the PARP protein right on top of the broken DNA strand. It creates this rigid roadblock.
Oh, wow. So the DNA strand is snipped open, and the repair mechanic is essentially glued directly onto the broken machinery.
Yes, and the result is catastrophic for the cell. This is called a TOP1 DNA cleavage complex. You have a broken strand with a protein trapped on it.
And then what happens?
Well, when the cell's replication machinery comes barreling down the DNA track to copy the genetic code, it slams into this roadblock.
Like a train hitting a boulder.
Exactly. Yeah. The replication fork collapses. What started as a manageable single strand snip shatters into a highly toxic double strand break.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the DNA is completely severed. The tumor cell undergoes massive unrepairable damage and just initiates self-destruction.
Wow. from a purely theoretical standpoint, that sounds like a flawless trap.
Yeah.
I mean, you break the tumor's DNA, and then you weaponize its own biological repair kit against it.
It's brilliant on paper.
But circling back to our melting bucket scenario, if this trap is so perfect, what was the historical roadblock? Like, when doctors tried this in previous clinical trials, what actually happened?
They hit a wall called dose-limiting toxicity, specifically severe myelosuppression.
Myelosuppression, that's the bone marrow issue, right?
Right. When you give these two drugs systemically, they don't just find the tumor, they go everywhere. And what tissue in the adult human body is constantly rapidly dividing, much like a tumor?
The bone marrow. Because it's constantly pumping out, what, red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets?
Exactly. Because those bone marrow cells are rapidly dividing, their DNA is constantly unzipping, making them incredibly vulnerable to this exact same DNA damage trap.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, when previous trials gave patients a TOP1 inhibitor and a PRP inhibitor at the same time, the combination essentially wiped out the patient's immune systems and blood supply.
That's devastating. The collateral damage was just too high.
Way too high. To keep the patients alive, doctors had to drastically reduce the doses.
How drastically are we talking here?
Down to just 3% of the standard PIRP inhibitor dose and roughly 40% of the standard TOP1 inhibitor dose.
3%? Wait, at that point, you aren't even administering a therapy. That's practically a homeopathic dose.
Yeah, and unsurprisingly, at those reduced doses, the treatment became completely ineffective against the tumors. The doctors were trapped in this biological paradox.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Exactly. If you give enough of the combined drugs to kill the tumor, you destroy the marrow. If you protect the marrow by lowering the dose, you let the tumor grow.
You know, if you're listening to this and wondering why on earth researchers didn't just throw in the towel, I mean, it's a valid question. If a chemical combination burns a hole through the floor, the logical step is to stop using it and look for a completely different chemical. Why stubbornly stick with these two drugs?
Because the synergy of that double-strand DNA break was undeniable. The mechanism was just too potent to abandon.
They knew it worked.
Right. The cancer cells were incredibly sensitive to it in the lab. The researchers behind the new study realized the problem wasn't the biology of the drugs. The problem was the logistics of how they were being delivered.
Okay.
They needed to keep the chemicals from meeting in the bone marrow.
Which brings us to the two-pronged solution they developed.
Yeah.
Let's start with the first part of the logistics, which is the delivery mechanism. How do you get a drug to ignore the bone marrow and only go to the tumor?
They utilized a drug called CRLX101. Now, this isn't your standard free-floating TOP1 inhibitor. It is a nanoparticle formulation of camptothecin. They packaged the active drug inside a microscopic polymer carrier.
Okay. Think of it like a slow-release fertilizer capsule you put in your garden.
Right.
If you pour liquid fertilizer directly on a delicate plant, it might burn the roots. But a capsule protects the plant and only releases the nutrients under very specific conditions. But how does this microscopic capsule know to accumulate in a tumor?
It takes advantage of something called the Enhanced Permeability and Retention Effect, or EPR.
EPR, okay.
Yeah. When tumors grow rapidly, they are desperate for a blood supply, so they hastily build their own blood vessels. But these tumor blood vessels are poorly constructed.
Shoddy workmanship.
Exactly. They are structurally shoddy and highly leaky, unlike the tight, well-formed blood vessels in healthy tissue like the bone marrow.
So as the nanoparticles are circulating in the bloodstream, they safely bounce past the tight walls of the healthy bone marrow. But when they reach the leaky plumbing of the tumor, they just slip right through the cracks.
Yes, and because tumors also have core lymphatic drainage, once the nanoparticles fall through those cracks, they get trapped there.
They can't get back out.
Right. They accumulate deep inside the tumor tissue, slowly dissolving and releasing the TOP1 inhibitor directly into the cancer cells. It essentially localizes the first half of our DNA trap exactly where we want it.
Okay, so that solves the delivery problem. But if you administer the PRP inhibitor at the same time, wouldn't you still amplify whatever small amount of the TOP1 drug happened to be circulating in the healthy marrow?
You would. And that is why the nanoparticle alone wasn't enough. The second half of the solution is a strict timing protocol called gapped scheduling.
Gapped scheduling.
Yeah, the researchers needed to figure out exactly how long the bone marrow took to process and clear any minimal exposure to the first drug. Interestingly, to figure this out, they relied on preclinical models using rats rather than the traditional mouse models.
Wait, why does the specific rodent matter for testing bone marrow toxicity?
It matters deeply because mice are remarkably resilient when it comes to blood cell recovery. A mouse's hematopoietic stem cells cycle and recover from stress far faster than human cells do.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if you test bone marrow toxicity in a mouse, you will get a false sense of security. Rat bone marrow, however, has DNA repair dynamics and recovery timelines that much more closely mimic human marrow.
That's fascinating. So the rats gave them a more realistic window of human vulnerability. What was the magic number they discovered?
48 hours. The rat model showed that if you introduce a strict 48-hour delay, you can mitigate the catastrophic marrow toxicity.
Okay, so how does that look in practice?
So the clinical protocol became this. Administer the CRLX-101 nanoparticle on day one. Let it circulate, let it fall through those leaky tumor vessels, and let the bone marrow process and clear its minimal exposure.
Like clear out.
Right. Wait entirely through day two. Then on day three, start administering the PRRP inhibitor, olaparib.
Okay, so by gapping the schedule, you give the healthy bone marrow time to clear the area and reset. But because the nanoparticle is physically stuck inside the tumor, slowly releasing its payload over time, the cancer cells are still fully primed and vulnerable when the PRP inhibitor finally arrives on day three to spring the trap.
Exactly. The mechanism is elegantly simple once you map out the timelines, but, you know, the true test is whether this logic holds up in human biology.
Right. Let's transition to that real-world application. They move this Trojan horse and 48-hour timer strategy into a phase I clinical trial with 24 human patients. Now, phase I trials are primarily about finding the maximum tolerated dose.
Yes, safety first.
Given that previous trials couldn't get past 3% for the PRP inhibitor, how high were they able to push the doses with this new logistical approach?
The results were staggering. At their target dose, which they called dose level 4R, they administered 12 milligrams per square meter of the CRLX-101 and 250 milligrams of the olaparib twice daily.
And what does that mean in percentages?
Using this gap schedule, they safely achieved roughly 80% of the single agent maximum doses for both drugs simultaneously.
Wow. Going from 3% up to 80% is a massive expansion of the therapeutic window.
It's a total game changer.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. How do we know the drugs were actually interacting inside the body? If the nanoparticle takes 48 hours to settle, how do doctors verify the trap was actually set and triggered at a cellular level without, you know, cutting the patient open every 2 days to check the tumor?
That's a great question. They needed a non-invasive way to measure pharmacodynamics, to prove the drugs were causing the intended DNA double-strand breaks. So they looked for a highly specific biomarker called gamma-H2AX.
Gamma-H2AX. What exactly is that?
It is a phosphorylated histone protein. Basically, when DNA suffers a severe double-strand break, the cell's machinery rapidly tags the surrounding area with this protein.
Like a biochemical flare.
Precisely. It marks the exact site of the catastrophic damage. To find these flares without performing invasive organ biopsies on these highly vulnerable patients, the researchers did something incredibly clever. They plucked hairs from the patient's scalps.
Wait, scalp hair? How does a hair follicle tell you about DNA damage from a cancer drug?
Because hair bulbs contain keratinocytes, which are actively rapidly dividing cells.
Oh, just like the tumor in the bone marrow.
Exactly. They are highly proliferative, making them a fantastic surrogate tissue to observe how drugs impact DNA replication in real time. They plucked hair follicles on day one for a baseline, then again on day three, 48 hours after the nanoparticle.
And what do they see?
They saw a clear increase in the gamma-H2AX flares, proving the TOP1 inhibitor was successfully causing the initial single-strand breaks.
Okay, so the first half of the trap was set.
Yes. Then they plucked hairs again on day four, 24 hours after starting the PRP inhibitor. The biochemical flares spiked even higher.
Wow.
Yeah, the DNA damage signal amplified significantly, providing definitive molecular proof that the 1-2 punch was actively synergizing in human tissue.
Okay, but finding a chemical flare in a hair follicle proves the biological mechanism is sound across the body. But pharmacodynamics on the scalp doesn't automatically equal a shrinking tumor in the pancreas or the lungs, right?
No, it doesn't.
The microenvironment of a solid tumor, the acidity, the blood flow, is vastly different from a hair follicle.
Mm-hmm.
When they looked at the actual clinical outcomes for these 24 patients, did this gapped therapy actually halt the cancer?
That is the critical limitation of surrogate tissues, which the authors openly acknowledge. A hair follicle proves the drugs are working as intended, but only patient scans can prove efficacy. And keeping in mind that these were patients with highly advanced solid tumors who had already exhausted standard therapies, the clinical data was highly encouraging.
Yeah.
Out of 19 patients who were evaluable for a response, 2 achieved partial responses, meaning the tumors shrank significantly. 6 more achieved stable disease, meaning their tumor growth was halted.
I mean, in a population that has failed multiple lines of prior chemotherapy, stabilizing the disease is a profound victory.
It translates directly to time. The median overall survival was 6.06 months. But the individual patient stories are even more striking.
Like what?
There was a patient with relapsed myxofibrosarcoma who had a deep, sustained response lasting over 7 months. Another patient, battling heavily pretreated cholangiocarcinoma, which is a notoriously aggressive bile duct cancer, maintained a partial response for 6 months.
That is remarkable time given back to those patients. Mm-hmm. Now, as we look deeper into the data, there is a fascinating genetic twist to who actually responded to this treatment. Usually, a patient needs a very specific genetic profile to even be offered a PRP inhibitor, right?
Traditionally, yes. This is a concept called synthetic lethality. Imagine a cancer cell has 2 different pathways to repair its DNA, pathway A and pathway B.
Okay, tracking.
If a drug blocks pathway A, the cell just uses pathway B and survives. But some patients have genetic mutations, like the well-known BRCA mutations in breast and ovarian cancer, meaning their tumor cells are born with pathway A already broken.
This is called a homologous recombination deficiency, or HRD.
Right.
So their natural spell checker is already fundamentally compromised.
Exactly. When you give a PRP inhibitor to a patient with a BRCA mutation, you are blocking pathway B. Because pathway A was already genetically broken, the cell has 0 options left and it dies.
Whoa.
That is synthetic lethality. And indeed, the myxofibrosarcoma patient who responded so beautifully in this trial had a mutation in a gene called PLB2, which functions very similarly to a BRCA mutation.
Okay, that makes perfect logical sense. The treatment worked because the patient had the expected genetic vulnerability. So what does this all mean for the other patients? What was the twist?
The twist was that patients without any obvious genetic defects in their DNA repair machinery also responded to this combination.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When the researchers analyzed the broader genetics of the responders versus the non-responders, they found no statistically significant correlation regarding who had these predicted loss-of-function variants. Having the genetic vulnerability didn't guarantee a response, and importantly, lacking the mutation didn't rule out a response.
But if the cancer cells had a perfectly healthy pathway A, how did the treatment still kill them?
The prevailing theory is that the physical mechanism of trapping the TOP1 enzyme and the PRP protein directly onto the DNA strands creates such an overwhelming amount of catastrophic double strand breaks that it entirely exhausts the cell's repair capabilities.
It just overloads the system.
Right. It doesn't matter if the cell has a healthy spell checker. You are essentially throwing a wrench into the printing press itself. The gapped combination creates a synthetic vulnerability on the fly, overpowering the tumor, regardless of its underlying genetic background.
So what does this all mean for the future of oncology? If specific mutations like BRCA or HRD scores aren't the ultimate gatekeepers for this combination therapy, this could broaden the horizon for who is eligible for these treatments.
It entirely blows the doors open. The next step is larger biomarker-enriched phase 2 trials to refine exactly how we predict responses. We might need to look at the real-time expression of certain proteins in a tumor, rather than relying on static genetic mutations.
That makes sense.
It suggests that highly potent gap-scheduled therapies could become a broad-spectrum approach for tumors that exhibit high replication stress.
Let's distill all of this into a clear takeaway. What we've explored today is a masterclass in medical problem solving. By combining smart delivery using a microscopic nanoparticle that exploits the leaky blood vessels of a tumor with smart scheduling enforcing a strict 38-hour gap based on the recovery dynamics of rat bone marrow scientists, successfully rescued a highly potent cancer therapy.
They really did.
They took a combined treatment that historically had to be dialed down to a useless 3% to prevent marrow toxicity and safely pushed it up to 80%, unlocking a new frontier in DNA damage response therapies.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this trial is really just the vanguard of a massive logistical shift in oncology.
How so?
Well, the concepts of gap scheduling and targeted delivery are paving the way for even more sophisticated tools. The paper highlights the future integration of ADCs, or antibody drug conjugates.
ADCs.
Right. Instead of a polymer nanoparticle relying on leaky blood vessels, imagine attaching the TOP1 inhibitor directly to an antibody engineered to seek out and bind only to specific proteins on a cancer cell's surface.
Like a microscopic heat-seeking missile.
Precisely. And alongside that, the development of next-generation PRP inhibitors. Current drugs inhibit both PRP1 and PR2 proteins.
Okay. Is there a difference?
A huge difference. Emerging research shows that inhibiting PRP is heavily responsible for the toxicity seen in red blood cell development.
Oh, so if you leave PRP2 alone...
Exactly. If future trials combine antibody drug conjugates with highly selective PRP1 inhibitors, this gap strategy could become exponentially safer and more devastating to the tumor.
Which leaves us with a truly fascinating thought to mull over. If we can use clever timing, biological gaps, and microscopic delivery vehicles to make impossible drug combinations safe and effective, what other failed historical treatments might be sitting right now in the medical graveyard?
That's the real question.
How many other highly toxic melting bucket therapies are just waiting for the right logistical delivery mechanism to bring them back to life?
It's amazing to think about. The answers to some of our hardest medical challenges might already be on the shelf, simply waiting for a new strategy of execution.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Late night monitors, steady fluorescent glow. A small white pill and a slow release flow. Two ways to break what the tumor will hide, but we learn not to hit it all at once. We learn to time the tide. Let the marrow breathe, let the next round begin. Damn, it shows up like a signal flare in the roots of hair, in the blood we carry there. Leave a gap for the courage, keep the gauge, leave a gap for the light.